Revolutionary talk for revolutionary times. Promoting peace, liberty, and prosperity around the clock. LibertyTalk.fm.
Welcome to Living the Solution with Dr. Elena George. Today we have an important show, one that, again, I think is very timely. And I think a lot of people hear this, but they're not sure exactly what's going on. And it's all emotion driven. And unfortunately, it's damaging our society. I think it's damaging the future of our country. And I think we need to speak about it. And today we're going to speak about climate change. And today we're going to have someone who can speak to it with just the facts. And I think if people understand things, then they're able to make conscious decisions. And today we're going to speak with Dr. H. Sterling Burnett. He is the director of the Arthur B. Robinson Center on Climate and Environmental Policy and the managing editor of Environment and Climate News. In addition to directing the Heartland Institute's Arthur B. Robinson Center on Climate and Environmental Policy, he puts Environment and Climate News together as an editor of Heartland's Climate Change Weekly email and the host. He's also the host of the Environment and Climate News podcast. Prior to joining the Heartland Institute in 2014, he worked at the National Center for Policy Analysis for 18 years. He ended his tenure there as a senior fellow in charge of environmental policy. He's held various positions in professional and public policy organizations, including serving as a member of the Environment and Natural Resources Task Force in the Texas Comptroller's E-Texas Commission. He's a former board member and past president of the Dallas Woods and Water Conservation Club, a senior fellow at the Texas Public Policy Foundation, an academic advisor for Collegians for the Constructive Tomorrow, an advisory board member to the Cornwall Alliance, and an advisor for the Energy, Natural Resources, and Agricultural Task Force at the American Legislative Exchange Council. So this is somebody who can speak to the topic that we're about to discuss with knowledge. And I'm looking forward to speaking with you. Mr. Burnett, thank you so much for joining me today. I really am looking forward to our conversation because I think we're being hit over the head with climate change and everything seems to be now caused by climate change. So Thank you so much for joining me.
Well, I appreciate you having me on.
Well, let's start from the beginning. You know, I remember back in the day, it was global cooling. I'm sorry, I think it started off with global warming, maybe. Then it went to global cooling. Neither one of those bore out. And now all of a sudden we have climate change, which really, it doesn't make a lot of sense to me because every day is a change. It's, you know, it's the weather changes constantly. So what does it really mean? And
well, you know, let's be careful not to confuse weather with climate because I don't want to be accused of that, right?
Okay.
So look, when I was a kid, and I won't speak to whether I'm older or younger than you, but when I was a kid, there were a lot of predictions of environmental doom. The environmental, the politically involved environmental movement was fairly new. Nixon was creating environmental agencies, environmental laws were being passed. And at the time, many of the same scientists who are now warning of climate change, at the time, we're warning of global cooling and the next ice age coming. It was headlines, Time magazine, you know, newspapers, magazines, scientific journals were all publishing articles about the coming ice age because we had been on a modest cooling trend for about 30 years. Now, that's how you measure climate. You don't measure climate in a single year or a single day. Those are weather. Those are random events driven by local factors. But when you average those over a 30-year period, they consider that sort of a measurement of climate. And so for 30 years, from the 40s through the 70s until the late, the mid-80s almost, they were warning of a global cooling. And then the temperature started changing. And within, you know, months to just a couple of years, people started talking about global warming, even though it was only 2 years in, 2 or 3 years in. There wasn't climate change yet. And so then they were warning of global warming. And, of course, it didn't matter whether it was cooling or warming. The solution was always the same. Bigger government. Every problem is bigger government. Then it became inconvenient to talk about global warming because they kept holding hearings, planning hearings that they had to cancel because of snowstorms, and they were getting mocked. I guess they didn't have the foresight of computer models to tell them not to plan global warming conferences during the middle of winter. But so then they start talking about climate change because, well, like you say, the climate changes all the time. But truthfully, climates don't change all the time. Weather changes all the time. Climate change is only measured, as I said, over a 30-year period. And the problem was they didn't have a 30-year period when they started making these claims. Now we've had 30 years of modest warming. Actually, it warmed initially, then it plateaued, and then it started warming a bit again. But the question is, you know, we're accused of being deniers. People like myself, who I consider myself a climate realist, we're accused of being deniers for what? For following the science. And the science says we've had a modest warming. It says nothing about what's caused this modest warming or the modest cooling before it. Or the modest warming that happened from the 1880s through the 1930s before that. What we can say for sure is that the earlier warming wasn't caused by greenhouse gases, because the large majority of human-caused greenhouse gases weren't in the atmosphere until after industrialization, major industrialization in the 1950s. And it can account for why it started cooling in the 40s. So, you know, the evidence that humans are causing the present modest warming is lacking. But yet they try to attribute everything bad, doesn't matter what it is, everything bad, to climate change. Mm-hmm. You get a fire, it's climate change. You get floods, it's climate change. You get drought, it's climate change. You get too much rain, it's climate change. Too many hurricanes, climate change. More powerful hurricanes, climate change. Less powerful hurricanes, no hurricanes, climate change. You know, I called it, I think the article that you brought to my attention was climate du jour season again. Well, right now we're in the middle of what has been called for the entirety of my life and before, hurricane season. We're 2 months in. How many hurricanes do you hear about striking the U.S. this year so far?
None.
And yet you don't see headlines saying climate change to blame for no hurricanes, because they don't want to give any good news.
Mm-hmm.
Last year we had hurricanes, and we had them starting a little bit earlier than normal hurricane season. We had some early tropical storms in May and some hurricanes in June, not to peak. But we're well into hurricane season, and we've had, I think, four tropical storms forming the Atlantic. None of them have made landfall, and not a single hurricane. Now, if this continues, let's say we go for a few years where you don't have many hurricanes striking the U.S. and many strong hurricanes. They're going to say global warming is good for us, because the truth is one of the things that warming should do is cause massive wind shear at the top of hurricanes, which makes them break up. In addition, it should make them harder to form, because I'm in Tornado Alley. The difference between the ambient temperature at the surface and the temperature in the clouds is what drives strong storms. Well, according to climate change theory, since the temperature at the equator in the oceans, where most hurricanes form, isn't getting much warmer, but the temperature and the temperature at the surface is getting warmer, there's just not going to be much of a difference between the ocean temperature, as much difference between the ocean and surface temperature. So hurricanes should find it harder to form. But you haven't heard any of that. If you follow the science, that's what it says. Mm-hmm. But you don't hear any of that from the alarmist.
Well, it's only convenient, right? Whatever keeps the narrative going. And before, let's take our first break, because I want to go into more detail with the CO2 and how they're trying to manipulate that and our behavior. So let's take our first break.
Sure.
You're living in the solution. Welcome back to Living in Solution. We're speaking with Dr. Sterling Burnett. And he has an associate degree in arts and sciences from Eastville Community College, a BBA and a BA in cultural anthropology from Southern Methodist University, an MA and a PhD in applied philosophy, from Bowling Green State University. And he specializes in environmental ethics. And before the break, you mentioned something quickly, but I want to make sure people understand that. We talk about greenhouse gases and CO2 in particular. From a science perspective, and if I'm a biology major, photosynthesis is necessary. You have to have CO2 in order for the environment to reproduce, for plants to thrive. How do they just negate real biology as if CO2 is now also, all of a sudden the enemy?
Yeah, honestly, I can't, I'm asked all the time to explain why people say the things they do or why they believe the things that they may actually believe. And I can't. I can't get into people's psychology. So I don't know why they say or why they negate biology. But I will say this. If we'd had the 24-hour news cycle and reporters needing headlines in the depths of the last ice age, say 18, 20,000 years ago, what they would have been reporting on was the dangerous decline in carbon dioxide levels. Because 18, 20,000 years ago, if you look at the Earth's history geologically, because that's the kind of time you need to be doing, the Earth has had much higher levels of carbon dioxide in the past. When most plants evolved, the Earth's carbon dioxide was, thousands of parts per million, not the 400 parts that we're at right now. But over time, carbon dioxide has been drawn down. It's been drawn down by plants into the soil, into their roots, where it got locked in the soil. It's been drawn down and turned into carbonaceous rocks that store the carbon permanently. It's been drawn down into fossil fuels. So about 20,000 years ago, in the middle of the last ice age, we were down to 180 parts per million of carbon dioxide. Now you say, well, what does that mean? I'll tell you what it means. At 150 parts per million, plants can no longer undertake photosynthesis and they die. And when plants die, everything goes right along with it. That's game over, folks. We're dead. Human civilization dies. It hadn't been founded yet, and it's 20,000 years ago, but we don't have the Industrial Revolution. We don't have all sorts of things. But what we don't have is just life on Earth because plants are dead. Over a long period of time, it's drawn down like that. Well, as has happened in every previous interglacial cycle when we came out of ice ages, CO2 started to rise naturally, and we got up to 280 parts per million. So it rose 100 parts per million before humans started emitting car exhaust and coal-fired power plant emissions into the atmosphere. But once we did, it's now gone up in the last 150 years by about 120 parts per million. So, but we're still far below what it was historically, far below what it was when life evolved on Earth, when plants evolved on Earth, when animals evolved on Earth. People say, oh, it's the highest it's been in 300,000 years. Okay. Did humans exist 300,000 years ago? Did plants exist 300,000 years ago? Were animals around 300,000 years ago? Well, yeah, they were, and they were doing okay. So it's hard to understand how they came to the conclusion that CO2 is a danger. And in fact, the father of global warming theory, a physicist from, I think, Sweden or Switzerland, Sven Arrhenius, came up with the idea that we were putting greenhouse gas in the atmosphere and it would cause a warming about 100, more than 100 years ago, a couple of hundred years ago. And he concluded that it would be good for us. And in fact, that's what a lot of scientists believe, is that, look, there's a reason why we pump CO2 into the greenhouses. Plants grow better with more CO2. They evolved when CO2 levels were higher. They're starving. We're making them grow. And in fact, 70% of the greening of the earth is due to CO2, and the earth is greening. So plants are doing better. Food production is better. It's not toxic to us. You can go into it with a CO2 reader in any classroom that you're sitting in, and you'll get natural ambient temperature CO2 readings of about 700 parts per million. So 300 parts per million. If you hold it up to your mouth and breathe through it, you get about 1,500 parts per million coming out of your lungs. It's not toxic. It is good for plants. And if it's good for plants, it's good for life on Earth. Because everything depends upon plants. Your insect life, your animals, your herbivores, your omnivores, your carnivores. Ultimately, they all depend on the basic food chain, which is plants, and they need more CO2.
That's pretty clear. And I want to segue from CO2 to methane, because that's another...
Completely different animal.
So is the, well, getting rid of the animals that produce methane, first of all, is it a negative contribution to life on Earth?
Well, let's be honest. Anyone who's stood around a feedlot or a swamp or a municipal waste facility and smelled what's coming off, no one likes the smell of methane being released into the atmosphere too much. But methane is a valuable source of, it's natural gas. And if you capture it, you can burn it. You clean up the smell and you get a lot of energy from it. And of course, that's what we've done in the last decade. We've been producing a lot more natural gas the last decade and a half, and it brought our energy costs down, at least initially. Mm-hmm. And it made our energy system reliable as environmentalists were shutting down fossil coal-fired power plants. It's only as we start adding more and more renewable power to the grid and forcing it on there, regardless of its merits, in place of natural gas and coal, that the grid across the United States has become unreliable. We're having more blackouts and brownouts and planned outages now. And they say, oh, well, during peak periods, we can't keep everything on. Well, why could we keep everything on 20 years ago? Well, we've changed the grid a lot in 20 years. We've made it more and more reliant on energy sources that depend on whether Mother Nature cooperating. A coal-fired power plant doesn't care if it's raining outside or snowing outside or hot outside. It works. It doesn't care if the wind blows. It works. Wind turbines aren't like that. Neither are solar panels. So we've taken an electric grid designed by engineers and replaced it with one designed by politicians who aren't engineers.
And what could go wrong, right?
Yeah.
I want to actually talk about the coal burning plants. I mean, yeah. The technology has changed, has it not? I mean, it's much cleaner now. You always get this mentality or this mindset that it's spewing out, you know, toxins and it's totally dirty energy, but has not
every time.
Oh, go ahead.
Go ahead. Sorry.
Well, I'm just curious. No, hasn't it changed? Hasn't the technology advanced? And isn't it a lot cleaner than it used to be?
Well, no, there's no question it has. It's cleaned. It's cleaned itself up in part because of efficiencies. You know, it made sense economically for them, and it's changed in part because of laws and mandates. Now, it's not clear that some of those laws didn't slow the transition. Because they set a floor that was pretty easy to meet. And once they met the floor, they didn't feel the need to make a lot of changes. But let's talk about, you're talking, there's two different things, you know, coming out of coal fuel power plants or any fossil fuel power plant. I'm not just talking about coal, but coal is the dominant form of electric power, dominant electric power source until about a decade ago. You have emissions of pollutants. So you have your nitrous oxide, what are called criteria pollutants, what the EPA used to say, these are pollutants. And they were, you know, carbon monoxide, lead, sulfur dioxide, which was a real problem coming from coal plants, nitrogen oxides, particulate matter, which was also another problem coming from coal plants. And those have largely been cleaned up. When you see pictures of a coal plant today that the news runs, they're almost always plants from the 70s because they want to solve the pollution coming out of the smokestack. They're not showing a modern coal fuel power plant with no pollution, but maybe some water vapor coming out of the smokestack. And then there's the other emission, which is carbon dioxide, which is not a pollutant. If it's a pollutant, every one of us is polluting the atmosphere every time we exhale. Joggers are the worst, right? Because they're exhaling, you know, bikers, athletes, oh my God, they're real polluters because they're exhaling a lot.
It always seems like a zero-sum game to these folks. If there's not by accident, there's never any positivity. This is all recyclable. If you're producing CO2, oxygen, there's more oxygen, water in the atmosphere, you're having a greener, they don't want that because it becomes a closed system that regenerates on its own that you can't exploit. I mean, that's what it seems to me. Maybe I'm a little cynical, but my mindset is always follow the money. And if there's some gain to be made, they're going to create the problem because they're going to have the solution.
It's yes and no. I don't think it's just money. Look, Bill Gates and Jeff Bezos and so many others, you know, you can name your billionaire, Larry Fink at BlackRock, name your multi-billionaire. They've got all the money in the world. But you know what they can't do is issue subpoenas and make you show up and lock you up if you don't do so. Mm-hmm. You know who can do that? People who are much less wealthy than they are, but they've got power. And that's what it's really about. It's not about money. Money can give you influence. It might buy you power. But it's not in and of itself power. Politics is power. And all of the solutions proposed by environmentalists don't require market solutions. They require government getting involved and mucking about in people's lives, telling other people, it's always other people, how to live their lives. No one pretends that Leonardo DiCaprio, who takes his private jet to win an award for saving the environment, that John Kerry, that Al Gore, former President Barack Obama, who one of the first things he did after leaving office was buy a house on the beach that he said would, when he was president, would no longer be around because of climate change. No one pretends their lives are going to change one iota if these policies are enacted. It's elites forcing others not to be able to drive their cars. Rich people will still have their cars. It's poor people that won't have cars and won't be able to take personal transit. Rich people will still have their jets or be able to fly even commercial, but poor people won't. And developing countries, God forbid, they develop like we have and get what we have, air conditioning and modern refrigeration, and they're not dying in infancy. They're not starving. God forbid they get a coal fuel power plant that saves lives so they can go to a hospital at night. It's elites telling everybody else how to live because it's convenient for them. They need SERPs. They need people down on the farm doing the hard work while they sit, you know, overlooking their infinity pools, smoking their cigars, drinking their scotch, and saying, oh, well, we saved the environment. Now, go plant that tree. Fix my car, but don't drive to work yourself in a car to get there to fix it. Walk or bike or take public transit. It's really about the elite having lifestyles that allow them to look down upon the poor even more than they already do. And you only do that not with money, but with power. And that's why it is rich people. The elite are part of the rich. But when they want real power, they have to go through politics. They have to have laws passed. They have to have regulations. A lot of times the rich are passing regulations, climate regulations, that benefits their business, right?
Yeah.
You know, one of the biggest promoters of wind is a guy that ran for president as a Democrat. I forget his name now. Been a couple of years now since I've heard his name. But he made his money as an investment banker in coal. But as soon as he made his money, he sold off his coal and started promoting wind because government was financing wind.
I think that's another follow the money, where these money windfalls go. And let's take our second break because we're on a hard break and come back. You're living in the solution. Welcome back to Living the Solution. We're speaking about climate change. And before the break, I think you did a wonderful job, Dr. Burnett, of giving us the bigger picture. I think you're right. You know, I don't think about this often because usually money, especially in healthcare, is a major driver. But I think ego, and I always have something chilling when people say, I want to change the world. It's never in the majority's interest. And it's usually something that's very selfish involved with it. So I absolutely agree with what you said. It is about power and being able to control. It's all about control, really. And
yeah, there's no,
and that's, sorry, nothing's new under the sun, right? But what they do, right, I think that they're very masterful at, is divide and conquer. So instead of people being able to see the big picture, which you just described, it's okay for me to take a private jet, but you have to walk, or you have to be in a dark 200 square foot unit instead of a house because climate change. You know, but what they're doing is they're saying racist, sexist, is whatever is they're putting in there. How do people withdraw their consent from this? I mean, it's, people are so emotionally driven, and people are good, I think, right? They want to do what's best for everybody. They don't want to be selfish, but in actuality, we're all getting hit while other people are benefiting.
I guess I would say people are self-interested. That's what evolution made us. That doesn't make us selfish, but it means that we do care about ourselves, and we care about those that are closest to us. And we care about them more in general than we care about random people far off. The point I made about rich versus, you know, money versus power. Look at someone like Elon Musk. He's the richest person on earth, but they're trying like heck to tear him down as soon as he challenged wokeness and he challenged the idea that you can just green energy everything away, even though he's a big electric car promoter. He said, you can't get rid of the internal combustion engine right now. So as you start saying stuff like that, people have been going after him left and right, and it's working. There's an old adage. I forget the exact statement, but it compares basically the mob to the government. And they said, the mob might be sated just if you pay them off. All they want is money. Just give them a little money, and they don't care about your personal life. They don't care who you're married to or anything. Just pay them at a regular interval, and they leave you alone. What's dangerous is people who think they should control you, not because of their own interests, but because they think they know what's in your best interest. Mm-hmm. Moral scolds who think they know what's best for the world, they know what's best for you, because they have no concept that they might be doing wrong. The mob doesn't pretend like when they're robbing you that they're doing right. They know they're in it for that. But someone who has no conscience about forcing you to live the life they think you ought to live, they don't have any guilt at all. There's no concept of guilt for people like these, because they think it's not just not guilt. They actually think they're doing the morally right thing. They're congratulating themselves as they force you into slavery.
These are zealots, so, it sounds like. Yeah, it sounds like a religion to them.
Well, no, it is a religion. And you know how, you know, climate change is religion. You test it. Science is built on the idea that everything is testable. You propose a hypothesis to explain some phenomena. In this case, the Earth has started warming a bit. And then you develop a theory for why that would happen, what forces could be at play, what the interactions might be, and what the response might be. And then you say, here's my theory. Go out into the world and test it against reality. And the more the projections you make based on your theory prove to be true, the more likely the theory is to be true. But the more the theory, you know, when you make your projections and they're wrong and wrong and wrong, the less likely your theory is to be true. That's how science progresses. That's how science is supposed to work. That's what you learn in middle school, early science class. That's not how climate science works. If the theory, if the prongs of the theory are proven wrong, you question the prongs. You question the evidence, not the theory. Or you come up with new projections, which project conveniently what actually is happening as opposed to what you said would be happening. And then when that changes, you change it again. But what you don't do is throw out the theory. And that's not how science progresses. That's religion. That's faith. And I've got nothing wrong with faith, but I don't pass off my faith as science.
That's a really good point. And I don't think it's just the climate side of this. It's also medicine as well. And there seems to be an underpinning to this, these various religious movements. The people who are espousing it, they stand to gain. There is an economic connection between what's going on, because the way this system seems to work, if there isn't somebody who's going to question it, they get removed socially from a platform, even physically just taken out of the equation. So there's only one argument and every other voice gets censored. That's also anti-science, because it's about conversation between colleagues, coming, you know,
about
putting
debate.
Out your theory. And right. And that doesn't exist in this.
Transparency.
Yeah.
Yeah. Being transparent. Exchange of ideas and dispute of ideas and refining ideas because of things that were found during the dispute and the debate. Unfortunately, like I said, that's not how climate science works. Now, you know, you got some real true believers that I don't think are gaining a lot. Maybe psychologically they're gaining a lot. Maybe they just feel good about themselves, even though they're living with a hair shirt on. I know people like a guy named Bill McKibben, who's one of the leaders of the radical environmental movement. Who lives in a small house. I mean, he lives the lifestyle that he espouses for others.
Mm-hmm.
I'll give him credit for that. He's not a hypocrite. He lives that lifestyle. He's vegan. He doesn't, keep money that his organizations make. He's got a small house that he heats, I think, with a wood-burning stove. He forewent having children, and he thinks everyone else ought to, too. But the point is, if he gains, it's a psychological gain in the sense of, I'm doing what's right. And the problem is, him believing he knows what's right for everybody on Earth. His worldview is the only correct worldview. And if you don't believe it, you're a villain. If you don't follow him, you're evil and you must be destroyed. And that's why so many of these Congress people who cite his work say, we've got to stop debate. We've got to silence so-called deniers. We got to compare them to Holocaust deniers. And if necessary, some of these guys have said, we've got to lock them up. A lot of the environmentalists like China, but I don't really think they like China's results. They don't laud them for putting out more CO2 than every industrialized country combined. What they like about China is the authoritarian government. They say you can get things done. They like authoritarianism.
Yeah.
They think if you just had the right authoritarians, not the Chinese commissars, but if you just had the right authoritarians, you could get things done. And they're the right authoritarians.
Well, there's no such thing, is there? I mean,
of course not.
Right.
Of course
so,
not.
I mean, the delusion is real. But, I mean, but again, when you're a zealot, you don't see that. It's one, my way or no way. And it's a complete, as you said before, how can you're living in the same world as all of us. Do you not see what happened in Texas, for example, was it a couple of weeks ago, where they were talking about their wind power wasn't generating enough power, so they were going to have brownouts? How do they, just as a rhetorical question, but you're seeing your theories in action and they don't work. What, I mean, how do you just keep going on the same path?
The point is, for them, they are working. They're doing precisely what they really intend, which is to make people suffer, to make them do without, to make them turn off the air conditioning and turn off the lights, to live with less. Bill McKibben lives the lifestyle that he wants you to live. So he's happy when the grid collapses. Now, not everybody who claims to believe what he believes is. Not everyone is a true believer. Do you think, is Al Gore a true believer? I don't know. What I know is he's made a lot of money off the climate game, and he's made a lot of money. A lot of his money he made from selling his television company to a company owned by oil sheiks. Oil money directly bought his television company, and you didn't see him say, "No, I can't take that money. It's tainted. It's destroying the planet. I can't take that money. I'll hold on to my money losing television station." He didn't do that. I wouldn't be surprised if Bill McKibben and somebody like him had a television station, they wouldn't take the money. But most of these folks, ain't true believers. What they are is believers in power. It's not about protecting the environment for them. It's about protecting and not just protecting their power, expanding their power over people's lives because they believe they know how best how everyone ought to live.
Well, what you say puts a whole
and the climate, because climate is universal, right? Everybody lives in a climate. Climate change may happen regionally, but it's driven by physical forces that are universal from physics. So it's the perfect vehicle to exert ever more control over people's lives. You got to have coordinated action. You can't let silly local governments or state governments or even national governments get in the way of concerted climate action. It takes global action. So you got to cede. You got to cede authority and sovereignty to international agencies and treaties.
Well, I want to go over that. So let's take our last break because there's executive orders that I'm hearing bandied about. There's UN involvement. There's all sorts of these treaties that aren't voted on by anybody who potentially can change our quality of life. So I want to go into that in more detail because I don't think people really think about it in big terms. So let's take our last break. You're living in the solution. Welcome back to Living the Solution. We're speaking with Dr. H. Sterling Burnett, and you can read his blogs at heartland.org and learn more about him. And Dr. Burnett, before the break, we were talking about treaties and global control. And let's go into that more in more detail, because I know the Supreme Court kind of took the power away from the EPA with climate, with their power over climate change and other things. I even think the HHS is getting involved with climate change. So,
no, every agency.
I mean, it's amazing.
This is a government. Biden says this is an all of government approach to fighting climate change. NASA is involved in fighting climate change and climate justice. I mean, environmental justice, why a space agency should be involved in justice matters, but it is. Housing and urban development, health and human services, every agency has to have a program discussing, addressing climate change and environmental justice. That's Biden's mandate. So it's not this odd one and that odd one. Every agency, every cabinet department under his control has climate programs.
So I really am not sure I understand what is climate justice, because it sounds very odd. What is that?
Yeah, environmental justice. Yeah, it's environmental justice before it was climate justice, but it doesn't matter. It's the same nonsense. It's the idea that certain things impact certain communities worse than others, and that it's all an evil, nefarious plot by corporations. So it started with the environmental justice movement, to some extent started with, they never want to extend environmental justice, by the way, to developing countries, because you talk about people who are really put upon, you know, what they're doing there is green colonialism, environmental colonialism of the West on developing countries, trying to keep them down so they don't emit things like we do. Even if it means they have to die today, presumably some people will be saved 100 years from now. But at home, what it means is, so you're a poor minority living in a poor neighborhood that happens to be near an industrial plant or a power plant or a refinery. And you're living near where emissions have historically been. When they were dirty, they were dirty there. Oh, that was racism. That's injustice. No. Why did they locate plants where they located them? Land was cheap. The poor weren't, it's about poor. It's not about race. Mm-hmm. The poor weren't politically organized. You try and locate a coal-fueled power plant in Highland Park, Dallas, you know, Texas, which is surrounded by Dallas, literally. It's a small city enclave, very wealthy in the middle of Dallas. You never got a coal-fired power plant there. And that was true now. That was true 70 years ago. It didn't happen. They were politically organized. They kept it out. but they were more than willing to have one located someplace else so they could buy the and have the power shipped to them. Well, that was a matter of poverty. And it turns out that minorities typically, many, you know, not Asians as much, but other minority groups typically are poorer than whites, or at least historically have been. So they live in poorer neighborhoods where a lot of these plants are located. But of course, those plants were also providing a lot of jobs. People, locals, often flocked to keep factories open. That environmental justice warriors came in and said, oh, they're killing you. We've got to shut this down. They said, hold it. They're not killing us. They're keeping us alive because they're providing us jobs. Mm-hmm. So it was once again environmental moral scolds knowing better what was good for the people living in an area than the people themselves. If you were only smart, you'd know that this is really not good for you, so you got to give it up. Thankfully, we do. You should pat us on the back. That's sort of what the environmental justice movement was located at. That, you know, but the claim was it was racism. Well, these plants are located there because it's racist. No, the plants are located there because the land was cheap. The people living there were politically disorganized. Sometimes people lobbied for these plants to be put there because they provided jobs and the community needed jobs. But every department, you know, NASA has to have an environmental justice. As far as I can tell, NASA's never instituted any racist policies whatsoever. They certainly haven't located places because they thought they could put one over on minorities. That, you know, they located places where the weather was good and where industrial facilities were good, access to major infrastructure. But NASA's got to have an environmental justice department now.
I mean, ultimately, I think it's like you said, more economic than it is any other ism. Everybody has to take a step back. They have to lose in order for this system to take off. And now I understand the mentality. You hear these people from the government come on TV and talk about about how great it is the gas prices are high and you should buy an electric car. Well, they like double the amount of money that it costs for an average car. God forbid your battery breaks down because it's worth more than the car when you purchase it. They just seem to just negate that and everybody should just get over it.
But
go ahead.
I'm sorry.
No.
I was watching this show, a news program out of England yesterday. I think it was the News Hour on PBS, and they were interviewing a woman in England where they've gone much farther along the climate madness, and where they've instituted these programs where your public transit and your departments all have to buy electric vehicles. This is a week after I was reading stories about these police departments in small towns in England, in rural areas in England, who were finding they couldn't answer emergency calls. People would call in from a rural farm or rural village that didn't have its own police department. So they'd call a police department and they'd start rushing out there and their car would run out of juice because it was battery powered and they'd been, you know, moving about in traffic all day. And so they ran out of juice in the middle of the country. So not only did they not get to the emergency and help these people, but they're stuck on the side of the road waiting for someone to come pick them up and charge their vehicle. And she's on this news program, oblivious to the facts on the ground, lauding the thing, the idea that we're moving towards a greener world where every car used by government is electric. Well, that's real good unless you're getting stabbed in a rural location, or your house is getting robbed and you need someone to show up.
Or if these
but
electric...
they don't care about that.
What about the grid, though? I mean, people act like it's just divorced from fossil fuel. But what's running
these electrical
grids, if that goes down and you have an all-electrical vehicle, what are you going to do then?
Well, that's what the police officer said. He said, look, it's not just... He mouthed what he was supposed to mouth. Oh, yes, we've all got to go green. But I'm a little concerned that we're moving too fast and that maybe we shouldn't buy more electric vehicles for the police right now. And now he didn't talk about the grid failing. What he talked about was there are no charging stations out in rural areas where we can charge if we need it. Very practical him, mm-hmm. Political. Yes. We got to have it, but also very practical. But you know what? We also have to have these vehicles ready to go. And so maybe we need some infrastructure in place before you start mandating we use these vehicles. Now, that's not even talking about the grid. You know, it's at the same time as they're mandating, you know, the various states are saying you've got to move to all electric vehicles. You can't have any natural gas appliances. You've got to, except, by the way, I will mention they're usually exempting commercial buildings. So because they want to keep their celebrity chefs in California, they don't want them moving something. You know, can you imagine Gordon Ramsay cooking on electric? It wouldn't happen. Wolfgang Puck, no, they move their locations. They're no longer there if you make them do that. So they exempt commercial establishments, but homes can't have gas. They've got to have electric. And you've got to have an electric car. And then you get warned not to charge your electric car at certain times of day, which are peak times. And if you do, you know, you'll break the grid. And so you don't have a car to escape fires when they come or whatever. They're literally making us more and more reliant on electric power at the time that they are at the same time, they're making the electric power supply, the electric power grid, less and less reliable.
At this point, how can we get better handle on this? I mean, ultimately, it's not a mandate at this point. What can people do to, do they go to their government agencies? Do they just use their pocketbook to make their voices heard? Because if we go down this path, we're going to be locked in our, you know, in a radius that you can walk, in a dark hovel. It's not really about quality of life at all.
No. Well, you know, you can pay attention. If someone tells you that he has magic beans that will make an electric system work without fossil fuels, you know not to vote for him the next election. he's promising you, he's telling you lies. If he says an electric grid that is dependent upon praying to the gods of Mother Nature, like our ancestors used to do, hoping the, you know, gusts of wind stay pretty steady, and hoping the clouds don't come over and block out the sun. If that's what he's telling you is a better system than one that you can just turn and flip on a switch and have fuel there, then he's lying to you, and don't buy it. Politically, that's what you can do, is to pay attention, to stay on top of it, to go to your locals and say, I will not take it. Do not teach my kids this crap in school. If you do, it's time for private schools or time for homeschooling, because I won't have my kid taught this crap. That's what you do at the local level. In addition, most people, I would guess more than 51% of people in this nation have some kind of retirement set up, not just Social Security. They have some stocks somewhere. They have some bonds. They have an IRA. They have a 401k, a 403b. They have, you know, a portfolio. Get active in how you manage that. Make sure you're not allowing someone to manage your fund that is painfully woke and elite. His only goal should be making profit for your funds so you can retire well. That should be all he cares about. And if he tells you he cares about the earth and wants to use your funds to fund his sustainable development and his sustainability goals, and he has, you know, their thing is bought into what they call ESG, environment, social, and governance programs, you need your funds and your money somewhere else. Because that tells you he's putting something besides your retirement well-being ahead of your retirement well-being. He's putting his personal view of what the future should look like. He's using your money to finance his fantasies, his or her fantasies. Be active investors. Be active in politics. I'm not telling you to run for office. I'm just saying you need to be aware. And if a politician tells you something that sounds suspicious, it's because it's acting suspicious.
If it's too good to be true, it's too good, right, to be true. It's not.
Yeah. Look, I would wager 90% of the politicians that I know, that I won't say I know, because I know very few of them personally, but I know a few. I wouldn't, if I had children, I wouldn't let them babysit my children. And if you wouldn't let them keep your children overnight, why in the hell would you let them run your lives?
On that note, we need to stop, unfortunately. Time goes way too fast, but you've given everybody a lot to think about and a lot of a lot of information that they can take their power back. So I want to thank you so much for coming on. How can people reach you and listen to your podcast?
Well, I appreciate you asking that, and I appreciate you having me on. So go to www.heartland.org. You can sign up to receive our podcast on your favorite device, or you can just listen to them online at heartland.org. You can sign up for my weekly newsletter. It's actually about three times a month. It's called Climate Change Weekly, but I take a week off every month from that. You can sign up for Environment and Climate News. You can go to our other climate websites, Climate Realism, Climate at a Glance. And if you care about things beyond climate, because I'm the first to admit that environment and climate is not the only important thing in the world, it just happens to be my area of expertise, go and check out our Heartland Daily News on our healthcare news or our budget and tax news. The world is a big place, and we, unfortunately, because we have politics, we've got to keep an eye on a lot of different pots boiling and a lot of people's hands, I'm mixing metaphor here, in the cookie jar.
Well, I absolutely agree. And again, thank you so much for joining me. I really enjoyed our time. And thank you for everything you do.
Well, thank you for having me. And don't hesitate to reach out if I can ever be of help again.
I certainly will. And thank you, everybody, for living in the solution.
Revolutionary Talk for Revolutionary Times. Liberty Talk FM.